This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's guest, Mark Wahlberg, has quite an eclectic resume. Pop star, hip-hop recording artist, TV producer, and movie star. Lately, on the big screen, he's established a new specialty, playing tough guy cops from Boston. He was nominated last year for his supporting role as a corrupt cop in Martin Scorsese's The Departed. And in We Own the Night, which has just come out on DVD, he plays another hard-bitten cop from the Northeast. Here's a scene from We Own the Night, which features Wahlberg's character going into his brother's nightclub. He's confronting some Russian mobsters who have begun hanging out there. Without raising his voice, without doing anything more overtly threatening than ripping up a stack of bills, Wahlberg makes it clear they're not wanted.
What is this?
Stay down.
Tough guy, huh? You want me to double your money?
Huh? Stay down.
There it is. It's double. How's that? You got anything in here? You got a cross and a Jewish star on you. What's the matter? You confused?
Not me.
What do you got?
This one's holding a couple dimes of cocaine and some PCP.
Good.
Turn around.
Your boy's gonna open up on you. And when he does, I'm coming back. All right, let's go.
Before he started his acting career, Wahlberg was briefly in an early version of the boy band New Kids on the Block with his older brother, Donnie. Terry spoke with Mark Wahlberg last year after his Academy Award nomination for The Departed. In that movie, Wahlberg plays a sergeant in the Massachusetts State Police Department. He's trying to bring down an Irish mob boss named Frank Costello in South Boston. Leonardo DiCaprio is the undercover cop on the case, infiltrating Costello's gang. In this scene, DiCaprio believes that the case and his life are in jeopardy because there's a rat in the police department. He's on the phone with Wahlberg, who speaks first.
Mark Wahlberg, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
In some of your roles, you're really not very talkative. But you're quite verbal in your role in The Departed and speak in a really stylish way. Was it a different kind of role for you verbally?
Yeah, it was verbally, but it was... I grew up in Boston, so basically I just had to revert back to my old accent and my mom and dad's speech pattern. And a lot of those cuss words are actually straight from my mother's mouth.
So, but finding like a really like stylish way of speaking too.
Well, there's just a rhythm to it. You know, Marty, when we read the script and I decided that, well, they were able to work out the schedule, he basically said to me, you know, say what you want and, you know, take out what you don't feel is real and authentic. And, you know, as long as you don't lose any plot points, just do what you want to do. So, you know, I've had a lot of experience with the Boston police. And like I said, my mom speaks like that, as well as my dad. So it's basically just kind of going back to the accent that I worked so hard to lose.
Did he talk with you about your character and like backstory for your character or any of that? Or is it just... You know.
We did. We'd have a lot of conversations about backstory, and he wanted me to pull from some of my real life experience. You know, but we'd start talking about the character, and I don't know if you've ever talked to Marty, but we'd start talking about the character, and then we'd be in the middle of a conversation about 17th century Irish immigrants. I mean, it would be a history lesson, and you know, the guy is just an endless source of information. So.
You say he told you to pull from your real life. What did you pull from? Like what?
Well, I had, you know, spent 15, 16 years of my life torturing my parents and, you know, being arrested and having to call them and tell them to come bail me out of various jails for various petty crimes. And, you know, there is a very fine line between cops and crooks in Boston. A lot of my friends that I got into trouble with at an early age went on to become cops. So all that real life experience, all that torture that I caused my parents, I was able to use, in playing this part.
So you see, was it really different to try to get into the mindset of a sergeant?
No, because you really have to, in order to be able to understand criminals, you have to think like them anyway. So I really, I had that part covered.
Right. What surprised you?
It's crazy, but you know, it really was. It really brought a lot of closure to a lot of you know, things that had kind of haunted me in the past. You know, redemption is a big deal for me to have been able to turn my life around and to really be on the right side of the law and to be able to learn to appreciate them and what they do.
Well, you actually spent, I think, like 45 days or so in a penitentiary?
Yeah, and I was 17 at the time, so it was certainly a frightening experience. But if that's what I needed to experience to turn my life around and to start living a positive life, then it was the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Is that what happened to you, that you turned your life around inside?
Oh, definitely. I like to be able to come and go as I please. I like to eat my mom's cooking. So losing my freedom was obviously a horrific experience.
So if you were about 17 and you were in like an adult penitentiary, mm-hmm. did you have to draw on acting skills you didn't know you had yet in order to kind of look tough and confident and be relatively safe inside?
Definitely. I mean, you don't want to walk around and draw too much attention to yourself either. But, you know, I was in an altercation the first day I was there. And, you know, they try to take my property and, you know, basically punk me. And when I was able to stand up for myself in a large holding cell, people kind of knew that I was prepared to do what I had to protect myself.
Is being young and attractive definitely a liability, like a liability when you're in prison?
Yeah, it's the worst thing possible. I mean, I never look at myself as being attractive, but certainly, you know, I had all of my teeth and I was young and I probably weighed about 110 pounds. I was probably about 5'2 at the time. I didn't really start growing until I was in my 20s. So, yeah, it was pretty frightening. I probably looked like a little young girl with no breasts. So... yeah.
Not what you want to look like in prison.
No.
That's where you started working out, right?
Working out, yeah. Uh-huh. Working out. And, uh-huh. Yeah.
So I guess you really did that with a lot of urgency.
Yes. I started before I went. I figured based on the horrible things that I had done and the pain that I had caused people that didn't deserve, that I was going to have to pay for my mistakes. I certainly had to just try to prepare myself as best as possible. And getting sober and doing all the right things was, I mean, that was all part of it.
I want to ask you a little bit about Entourage, which is the HBO series about a young actor who goes to Hollywood and with his whole entourage, and they're all kind of crazy, and he's very shallow and so on. And So you're an executive producer and creator of the series, and the series, I believe, is supposed to be loosely based on your early experiences in Hollywood?
Yeah,
very loosely based. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the cool stuff I'll take credit for, and anything that's embarrassing I want nothing to do with. But, you know, the part that's really based on my life and experience is the guys that are with me. The guys that worked with me, all of those characters are based on people that are really important parts of my life.
So who is in your entourage?
Well, the real E, the real Johnny Drama. Unfortunately, the inspiration for the Turtle character, one of my best friends, Donnie Carroll, passed away last year.
Oh, sorry.
You know, a couple of the guys, you know, have been with me and gone, like the Dom characters, based on a friend who got out of prison and try to help him out. And of course he didn't know that Hollywood is very different from prison, and he started trying to do some of his prison antics in the business and got the guys into a lot of trouble. So there's stuff that's based on me, and obviously there's stuff that's happened to other people in the business that I'm friendly with, and of course the writers are extremely talented and they make up a lot of stuff, but I'm so proud of those guys and what they've done with the show.
Tell us who Johnny Drama is based on.
Johnny Drama is based on a guy named Johnny Alves. I met Johnny Alves in California with my brother when I was on the road with my brother, who was in the New Kids on the Block. I had gotten out of jail, and being a guy who was trying to stay out of trouble in Boston is a really difficult thing to do. So when I got out, I wouldn't hang with my friends, and then all of a sudden I wasn't cool anymore. So I had gotten into a couple of fights just trying to defend myself, and I was arrested a few times while I was on probation and parole. So my brother hired Johnny Alves to come and work with me, basically to keep me out of trouble. And we went back home to Boston so I could make my court appearances. And he asked me one day to take him to Plymouth to visit his mom, because he's originally from Massachusetts as well. We went to Plymouth, and I walked in his kitchen, and I saw his mom walk by the hallway. And I said, "Oh, my, I know your mom." He said, "Yeah, shut up. He thinks I'm joking around." And I said, "Your mother works at the Plymouth House of Correction, the prison, right?" And he said, "Yeah, why?" I said, "Well, I was there for a month, and she used to come and pray with me all the time because she had never seen somebody so young and little in there before. And as soon as she came out, she recognized me, and we've been, you know, like family ever since."
No, the Vince, the character who's kind of like your loosely based surrogate in the series, spends money really extravagantly and is often egged on to do it by his friends and his entourage. Did you do that too? And if so, like, can you tell us about some of the, in retrospect, most foolishly extravagant purchases you made?
Well, the first check I got for $100,000 for my recording career, I went to a Mercedes dealer and bought a car for $100,000, and I didn't have money left over for insurance or registration or any of that, or gas.
That fits the bill.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, we're in town somewhere. I mean, I remember doing Boogie Nights, and Paul came over to my house with Phil Hoffman and John C. Reilly, and they were lighting fireworks off my balcony in California. I'm from Massachusetts, so I don't know the laws. And, of course, the next day I get evicted from my apartment. So I ended up renting a house that cost, like, I don't know, like $6,000 a month, and I only had, like, $10,000 in the bank. Just stuff like that, or taking my friends on a trip. You know, we were going to go to New York, for instance, then we missed the plane, so we decided to get a jet with money that we didn't have. But I always felt like, you know, if we just focused on doing the work and have fun and don't stress out, then the money would come. And you know, I was able to go and do concerts and stuff in Europe because I never wanted to take a movie for money. I always wanted to just grow as an actor and learn as much as I possibly could. So I would do spot dates in Europe and stuff like that to kind of pay the bills while I was, you know, pursuing my acting career.
Before you started acting, when you were younger, did you care much about movies?
I loved movies. I loved watching movies with my dad. You know, my dad worked so hard. He worked two jobs. I'm the youngest of nine kids, and my mom and dad always worked just to put food on the table. So whatever time I had with my dad was usually in front of the TV, or we would go once a week to the movies. He took me to see Hard Times with Charles Bronson. It was my first film that I ever saw. And, you know, I grew up watching McQueen and Cagney and Robert Ryan and John Garfield and Edward G. Robinson. You know, it was, that's what's so amazing about being nominated for an Oscar. I called my dad and he said, "Mike, do you know how many times I used to stay up at night and watch the Oscars as a kid?" It was a huge deal for him. So to hear him crying tears of joy because I was going to be on the Oscars and I was nominated, he was blown away by that.
Mark Wahlberg speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's conversation with Mark Wahlberg. His movie We Own the Night is now out on DVD. When Terry spoke to Mark Wahlberg last year, they talked about his starring role in Boogie Nights. He played a porn actor who rose to the top of his field, being invited to an adult film award banquet and winning. Terry asked him about the acceptance speech he made after winning that award.
I thought we could hear that speech, and this is in Boogie Nights, where you play like a young porn star rising in the field and wanting to make more serious films with like action plots and everything. So here you are accepting.
He definitely felt like he was accepting the Academy Award.
Exactly, and he's accepting like one adult film award after another. This is his night, and here's one of his speeches.
Wow, I don't know what to say. I guess, I guess the only thing I can say is I'll promise to keep rocking and rolling and making better films. You know, it seems you make these movies, and sometimes, you know, they're considered filthy or something by some people. But I don't think that's true. These movies we make, they can be better. They can help. They really can. I mean that. We can always do better. I'm going to keep trying if you guys keep trying. Let's keep rocking and rolling, man.
That's Mark Wahlberg in a scene
I think
from Boogie Nights.
I think he was. I think the award he was receiving was Best Penis.
Yes, but it's put slightly differently in the film.
Yeah,
I love that film. You played an actor whose gift, whose greatest asset is basically in his pants. You're not great at like the line reading parts of acting, but this performance really helped establish you as a terrific actor. When you first got the script for it, could you tell from a script what a really great film it was going to be?
Well, I read the first 30 pages and I had to put it down because I was really terrified. I thought, A, either this guy thinks I can really pull this off, or he just wants to kind of exploit me and finally see Marky Mark pull off the Calvin Klein underwear. So I had to put the script down. And it was something that I avoided reading for a long time. My agents were trying to get me to read the script. They were telling me how great it was, how many people were attached to it in the business, and how excited people were about it. But I was freaked out. And I had to go and sit down with Paul Thomas Anderson. And within 2 minutes of sitting with him, I knew exactly what he wanted and why he thought I could pull it off. And I still was pretty frightened going into it, just because, you know, I mean, Showgirls had just come out, and you didn't really know. You never know how things are going to turn out. You know, you think you're going to make something great, but it doesn't always turn out that way. But what an experience, you know, working with those actors and, you know, just day in and day out, being able to kind of work off of them. And as generous as they were with me, they really kind of walked me through the process. And I, you know, felt like after that I would be willing to try anything as an actor. And it was also, it was such a pivotal point for me, because I was still kind of trying to be that guy from the neighborhood. I was still trying to be the guy who people considered to be tough and cool, and this character wasn't that. He was vulnerable and insecure in a lot of ways, and weak in some ways.
And naive.
Yes, very naive. I just felt like, you know, if I want to be an actor, this is what acting's all about. You know, what am I going to play? The tough guy, you know, from Boston all the time who gets the girl? I mean, let's step up and really go for it.
So after learning how to really act confident in prison, now you had to, like, take that off and act vulnerable.
Yeah, but I was concerned with what people in the neighborhood were going to think. And then I'm thinking to myself, why am I concerned with that? That's why I'm so adamant about trying to encourage kids to go into the arts and to try to be creative, because, you know, you want to be either a tough guy or an athlete. I mean, there's more to life than that.
To make this film, did you watch pornography in a different way, like not to be turned on, but just to see what the acting's like?
I'm not a big fan of porn, but mm-hmm. There were certain things. There was a documentary about John Holmes that Paul wanted us to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the older films that we referenced, we watched, and we visited a porn set, which was pretty bizarre.
What was bizarre about it? Just how matter-of-fact
Everybody is, and the fact that, well, this guy's got to perform in front of all of us. We're all kind of standing around, you know, with coffees in our hand, waiting for it to go down. And it was just weird. It was a bit uncomfortable.
One of my favorite scenes in the film was where you and John C. Reilly and a third actor whose name I forget are at a drug dealer's house. And
yeah, Thomas Jane.
Yeah, yeah.
And Alfred Molina plays
the dealer, and he's like in his like underwear briefs and a like silk robe, and he's playing his favorite mixtape, and firecrackers are going off in the background, mm-hmm. and he's also got a gun, and he's obviously really crazy, and you've been dragged there by somebody who's also crazy, and you just want to get mm-hmm. out.
We had been shooting the scene, the movie, for such a long time. That was one of the last scenes we shot.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys hadn't worked a lot. Me and John C. Reilly especially were working all the time. So it took like 4 days to shoot, and they were really enjoying themselves. They were really getting into it. And like my character, I just wanted to get out of there. I mean, I was dying. And we'd been working, you know, long hours for such a long time. You know, I'm wearing high heels and tight pants and wigs and prosthetic penis and the whole thing, just, you know. I cannot wait to work, but when I work, I want to finish, you know. I want to get it all done, and I'm just weird like that. But no, it was an awesome experience. It's my favorite scene in the movie too. There's one that one take where I just kind of blank out for a few minutes, and he just kind of holds on me there. I really kind of blanked out at that moment.
Why?
I don't know. I had been hyperventilating to get, you know, to where the character was. They were all kind of high, and I just, I don't know, I just kind of blanked out for a minute, and they just kind of left the camera rolling on me, and then finally snapped out of it and remembered that it was my line, and Paul used that whole bit in the movie.
Mark Wahlberg, speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. Mark Wahlberg stars in We Own the Night, which has just come out on DVD. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. Here's Wahlberg in a scene from Boogie Nights. His character, porn star Dirk Diggler, is recording a demo trying to become a rock star. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Okay, Dirk, you ready?
Yeah, I was born ready, Nick. Let's go, man.
Dirk Diggler demo.
Keep the vocals up.
You got the touch. Take 7. Excuse me, Reed.
You got the touch. You got the power.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's rejoin Terry's 2007 interview with actor Mark Wahlberg, whose movie We Own the Night has just come out on DVD. He's also one of the executive producers of Entourage, the HBO series loosely based on his own early years in Hollywood. And in some even earlier years, right around puberty, Mark Wahlberg was a pop star.
So you were around 12 when you joined New Kids on the Block, and was it fun? Did you like it?
It was fun being in the studio and rapping and stuff, but, you know, going to vocal lessons and then doing the choreography and stuff, it just wasn't my thing. I was much happier being at the boys' club playing sports or running around at night with my friends. Of course, then going to jail and I remember sitting in a rec room in Plymouth House of Correction, and my brother and the rest of the New Kids came on TV, and they were performing, and I told this guy, hey, I mean, that's my brother. And he was like, that's not your brother. Shut up. I said, no, that's my brother. And I was in that group. I quit. And he goes, and now you're here. He goes, you got to be the dumbest guy I ever met. And then, of course, I had to wait till my brother was home, because he was constantly on the road promoting, to come and visit me at Plymouth House of Correction, which he did. And then I showed him off to everybody. And I was the cool guy in the unit for a week.
Well, it must have been really strange to watch him become such a big star after you quit and then end up in prison yourself.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, he wanted it, and he was willing to make all those sacrifices. And I wanted to be the cool guy in the neighborhood. I wanted to be what I thought was a badass. And I got what I wanted, and he got what he wanted. But obviously, it wasn't what I had expected.
So how did you handle stardom early on, once you got it?
I handled it okay. I mean, aside from the fact that I was, I don't know, with, my whole thing was I couldn't get girls to pay attention to me, really, until I was famous. So I acted like a bit of a jerk early on, but I realized quite quickly that I had no right to do that.
Well, you wanted to...
And, of course, my mom is one of the toughest people you'll ever meet. And any time I acted out of line, she was so quick to put me back in my place.
Uh-huh.
And she still does to this day.
Is that a good thing?
It's a very good thing.
So you wanted girls to pay attention to
you. It's not good
you.
When she's yelling and screaming at me at the time, saying, you're nothing, you're not a fucking movie star, you're nothing. You know, that's how she does it. But it was a short time after, I certainly realized that she couldn't be more right.
Well, after you were in the Calvin Klein underwear ads where you posed in your underwear, I think you became a pinup not just for girls but for boys too. And
yes.
What was your reaction to knowing that in some ways you were becoming something of a gay icon?
It was pretty weird at first, you know, because when you would go to a concert of mine, you would look in the crowd and there'd be a bunch of young girls and then there'd be a bunch of grown-up guys. And at first I'm thinking, well, they're probably dads or something, but, you know, then they're coming up asking, you know, for me to sign pictures of me in my underwear, and I'm saying, okay, what's your daughter's name? And they're like, no, it's for me, to Mike or Bob or whatever it is. But I got over the feeling uncomfortable about it pretty quickly. And then I just felt like, well, if I had an opportunity to speak to whoever and people wanted to listen or look, then that had to be good enough for me.
You know, when you were in music, you became best known for your hip-hop group. But in the movie Rockstar, you played someone in a heavy metal band that's basically a cover band or a tribute band that does its best mm-hmm. to copy in every way this famous heavy metal band that they love. And then when the lead singer is forced out of that band, they find out about your cover band and you replace that lead singer. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly, like for this role, you had like those long heavy metal curly locks. mm-hmm. And I guess I'm wondering what it was like to put yourself in a musical persona that was so different from the ones that you had actually had.
It was crazy. I mean, I would show up at metal concerts and stuff and people would recognize me and be thinking, what the heck am I doing there? But I wanted to really just dive into that world and become that guy until the movie was over. It took some getting used to, that's for sure. But I went out, I went shopping, I got, you know, I grew my hair, I bought all the clothes, I rented a house and put all kinds of musical equipment in there and just started hanging with the guys that were playing in the band and started drinking too much beer and, you know, acting like a jerk and doing the whole thing.
I want to play a scene from early in Rockstar where this is before you're just in a local band here and you've just heard the concert by the band that you cover in your own band. And you're in the arena parking lot afterwards and another fan-musician is taunting you about how you got the costume wrong and you're kind of bickering with each other about who's copying this band better. So yeah. Let's hear the scene.
Look who's here. Well, if it isn't Yoko Ono and Fag Five.
What do you think you're doing?
Making sure nobody gets scammed into seeing some cut-rate copy band.
Cut-rate copy band? This dude can't even tune his own guitar.
Yeah, and you could always use a little work on your lip sync.
I don't lip sync, Paul.
You're doing everyone a favor if you did, Burn.
You know, you could at least get the outfit right. I mean, your boots are from the Wasted Tour, and this is just like a cheap imitation of the Twisted jacket.
You are so fully wrong. Smoker. This is official issue. The actual vest Bobby wore on the Twisted Tour. My dad bought it from someone who knows Dragon's drum tech.
Look, I hate to break it to you, but your dad got ripped. First of all, the lapels are supposed to be blue. There's no green in the embroidery. As a matter of fact, can anybody here honestly say that they've ever seen Bobby Beers with a jacket with red lapels?
No, Chris, I can't.
I don't think so.
It's Mark Wahlberg in a scene from Rockstar. You know, I was just watching the DVD of Rockstar, and I was looking at one of the other guys in the heavy metal band. I'm thinking, I know him. And I realized, oh, it's McNulty from The Wire. And it must be so much fun for you to have...
Yeah, Dominic West.
Dominic West, yeah. It must be so much fun for you to have been in movies at the, you know, earlier in your career with people for whom it was also early in their career. And you can watch each other and how you've changed and what you've become known for subsequently.
Yeah. Yeah, even like, you know, working with guys like John C. Reilly and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, those guys are so talented. When I was working with them, I was like, these guys are amazing. How come they haven't done, you know, bigger and better things? And now they've all, you know, Phil's won an Oscar and John was nominated for an Oscar. And, you know, to just, you know, Julianne was nominated for Boogie Nights and Bert, you know, was his first nomination. It's been amazing. I went to the Golden Globes and it was wild. I saw all these amazing people that I had worked with early on, Bill Paxton, and you know, just to be there with all of them and sharing that with them was pretty amazing.
Well, listen, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Terry, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Mark Wahlberg speaking to Terry Gross last year. His movie We Own the Night has just come out on DVD. Coming up, actor Colin Firth. This is Fresh Air. The PBS anthology series Masterpiece is about halfway through its complete Jane Austen package. This weekend, it repeats a popular British miniseries from 1995, shown here when the PBS series was still known as Masterpiece Theatre. Jennifer Ely stars as Elizabeth Bennet, and Colin Firth co-stars as Fitzwilliam Darcy. establishing his leading man credentials years before he starred opposite Renee Zellweger in Bridget Jones's Diary, playing another Mr. Darcy. Terry Gross spoke with Colin Firth in 2001, when the first Bridget Jones movie was released. Let's start with a scene from Bridget Jones's Diary. Bridget has overheard Mark Darcy making sarcastic comments about her, and it's played on her insecurities and made her angry.
I mean, you seem to go out of your way to try to make me feel like a complete idiot every time I see you. And you really needn't bother. I already feel like an idiot most of the time anyway. With or without a fireman's pole.
Look, I'm sorry if I've been...
What?
I don't think you're an idiot at all. I mean, there are elements of the ridiculous about you. Your mother's pretty interesting. And you really are an appallingly bad public speaker. And you tend to let whatever's in your head come out of your mouth without much consideration of the consequences. I realized that when I met you at the turkey curry buffet that I was unforgivably rude and wearing a reindeer jumper that my mother had given me the day before. But the thing is, what I'm trying to say very inarticulately is that, in fact, perhaps despite appearances, I like you very much.
Apart from the smoking and the drinking and the vulgar mother and the verbal diarrhea.
No, I like you very much. Just as you are.
Colin Firth, welcome to Fresh Air. In a lot of your earlier interviews, you talk about how you really wanted to put Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice behind you. So what was your reaction when Helen Fielding asked you to play a part that was an homage to your portrayal of Darcy in Pride and Prejudice, thus continuing continuing the whole thing?
I suppose I did it in the spirit of if you can't beat them, join them. I wasn't strenuously trying to put it behind me. I think this creation, impression has been created to some extent. And, you know, I found that the Darcy tag didn't really touch me unless I was speaking to a journalist. So it really wasn't something that was disturbing me.
No, Pride and Prejudice is set in an earlier century. Your language and attire are more formal. I'm going to ask you to compare your acting style in each film, you know, like a literary adaptation versus a contemporary comedy. But first, let's hear a scene from Pride and Prejudice. And in this scene, you first confess your love to the character of Elizabeth Bennet, played by Jennifer Ely.
In vain I have struggled. It will not do. My feelings will not be repressed. You must allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you. In declaring myself thus, I am fully aware that I will be going expressly against the wishes of my family, my friends, and I hardly need add my own better judgment. The relative situation of our families is such that any alliance between us must be regarded as a highly reprehensible connection. Indeed, as a rational man, I cannot but regard it as such myself, but it cannot be helped. Almost from the earliest moments of our acquaintance, I have come to feel for you a passionate admiration and regard, which, despite all my struggles, has overcome every rational objection, and I beg you most fervently to relieve my suffering and consent to be my wife.
In such cases as these, I believe the established mode is to express a sense of obligation. But I cannot. I have never desired your good opinion, and you have certainly bestowed it most unwillingly. I'm sorry to cause pain to anyone, but it was most unconsciously done, and I hope will be of short duration.
And this is all the reply I am to expect. I might wonder why, with so little effort at civility, I am rejected.
And I might wonder why, with so evident a desire to offend and insult me, you chose to tell me that you liked me against your will, against your reason, and even against your character. Was this not some excuse for incivility if I was uncivil?
Let me ask you to compare your approach to contemporary romantic comedy, Bridget Jones, and dramatic literary adaptation, Pride and Prejudice. I mean, the speech is so much more formal in Pride and Prejudice.
It is. I think one just somehow instinctively adapts to the requirements. You can't say, you know, can I have a light in a formal Victorian way? You can't say, allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you very easily in, you know, in a kind of Bronx accent or a Cockney accent of the year 2001. So I think the Bridget Jones Pride and Prejudice case is quite a singular one, I think, because Mark Darcy is, in fact, very much a fugitive, I think, from another century. I mean, I think this is part of his problem. Mr. Darcy is very much a man of his time. He's isolated by other factors, but Mark Darcy, I think, is not typical. He's not certainly not typical of the Englishman of his age that I know. And I think that he comes from a rather archaic family, and I think that he's someone whose personality is crippling him in some way.
Just a question about your most famous scene from Pride and Prejudice. It's the famous pond scene. At the end of the story, you take off your jacket and with your shirt and pants on, you dive into a pond. And although it sounds pretty inhibited to dive in with shirt and pants, for your character, it's a sign of feeling more liberated and expressive.
Mm.
When you walk out of the pond with your wet clothes clinging to you, you became a heartthrob. Did you understand that?
Not really. It was so... That happened as a series of haphazard decisions. I mean, it was almost an accident, really, that led to the whole wet shirt business. And I think probably if anyone had connived at a phenomenon like that, they would have failed miserably. If I remember the original script, it was had it down that Darcy dives in completely naked. And... I suppose he might well have done that and is on his own property and it's a hot day. But the BBC didn't consider that acceptable. And then there was some talk of underwear. And then we heard that nobody wore underwear in those days. And I think there was an attempt to create underwear. A kind of, if they had worn underwear, would they have looked like this? And I went to be fitted with those, and there was no way on earth. And I can tell you now, had I worn those, there would have been no heartthrob.
What was this underwear looking like?
They were kind of knee breeches. I think they were cotton or silk. They looked like sailor's pants or something from, you know, pirate. I can't remember very well, but they came down just below the knee. And
little pantaloony kind of things?
Yeah. Not flattering.
Uh-huh.
And so in the end, I thought, well, what's second most spontaneous to taking all your clothes off and diving into a pond? I suppose really not taking any of them off, really. You know, maybe just jump in. And which is basically how I tried to play it. It's the jacket comes off and the vest comes off. Well, he just sort of sits there and thinks for a minute and then in he goes. You know, no way does anybody think that is going to start to, you know, that's going to become a famously remembered image.
Did it affect your career in a positive way?
I don't know. I really don't know. It's so hard to quantify these things. I think it must have done. I think that everything you do, I suppose, takes you in one direction or another, and I can't see that it would have been negative. I have an inclination, I've always, as an actor, had an inclination towards playing unhappy people, people who might be considered society's losers, and people who are unattractive. I tend to find that work as an actor far more interesting. And playing Mr. Darcy kind of took me a little bit further away from that. And I think there was a slight misreading of what kind of actor I was as a result of that. I think there was a feeling that this meant that perhaps I really was a romantic leading man, when I'm not, actually. I'm a character actor. And I think that's been confused because of this fairly neutral appearance that I have. But it was interpreted as a leading man performance, and it wasn't. Mr. Darcy was was absolutely a piece of character work.
Colin Firth speaking to Terry Gross in 2001. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews a new documentary, Taxi to the Dark Side. This is Fresh Air. Torture is back in the news thanks to congressional hearings into the practice of waterboarding. Torture also is the subject of the Oscar-nominated documentary Taxi to the Dark Side, which centers on the death of an Afghan cab driver in U.S. custody. Director Alex Gibney's previous documentaries include Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Taxi to the Dark Side. The title is portentous. It sounds like a horror movie. But in the first few minutes, we learn that in 2002, an apparently apolitical young Afghan cab driver named Dilawar got into his taxi and never came home. He died in Bagram Air Base after U.S. interrogators trussed him up and beat him repeatedly. Then we watch Dick Cheney tell an interviewer that to win the war on terror, the U.S. must be prepared to go to, quote, the dark side, which means the title is literal. And yes, this is a horror movie. Alex Gibney's documentary is about as good as Charles Ferguson's No End in Sight, which is to say, so lucid it's mind-bending. Ferguson's film, in competition with Gibney's for this year's Documentary Academy Award, set out to demonstrate how arrogance and incompetence in the first days of the U.S. occupation of Iraq created the best climate imaginable for the insurgency. Gibney takes the same nuts-and-bolts approach, but he gives the policy wonk stuff a human face. Poor Dilawar is our way into the subject of extreme torture. And the movie gives you the context in which to read the congressional testimony last Tuesday of CIA Director Michael Hayden, who admitted for the first time that the agency had used the technique of waterboarding. Aside from Dilawar, the first casualty of Taxi to the Dark Side is the theory that the abuse came from, in Donald Rumsfeld's words, a few bad apples. No one who's investigated the Dilawar case cites bad apples, especially not Tim Golden of the New York Times, who broke the story 2 years after it happened. He's in this clip after the defense attorneys for the soldiers prosecuted for Dilawar's death, among them Thomas Curtis, Anthony Morden, and the bald behemoth, Damian Corsetti.
It seemed like the military now, after they got a black eye from Abu Ghraib, wanted to get a public opinion that they were policing their soldiers. And so they said, we had this incident that happened a couple years ago. We could still prosecute some of them.
I had nothing to do with the military for 2 years, and all of a sudden I'm getting a call saying that I'm being court-martialed. I mean, that was a huge surprise for me.
From the defense perspective, I immediately said this is a political show trial. Willie Brandt is a good soldier. Good soldiers tend to obey orders. Good soldiers tend to be people who do what they're trained to do.
The interrogators on the ground, for the most part, didn't know what the rules were. They'd never been interrogators before.
My interrogation training consisted of, basically, they taught us some approaches, you know, how to get people to talk. And then, here, go watch these guys interrogate, which were the people that we were replacing, for about 5-6 hours before I did my first interrogation.
Damian was picked for this job because he's big, he's loud, and he's scary. That was his qualification.
Soldiers are dying. Get the information. That's all you're told. Get the information.
Slowly, judiciously, Gibney picks his way up the chain of command to the men who called the shots, Cheney and Rumsfeld, whose policy was to combine what analysts call a fog of ambiguity with relentless pressure for results. But do torture techniques work? CIA Director Hayden told Congress they did. But here, Professor Alfred McCoy lays out the history of sensory deprivation and waterboarding and says they can make a person psychotic in 72 hours or less and render much of the intelligence questionable. Waterboarding helped elicit the bogus confession of Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi that Saddam Hussein trained al-Qaeda operatives, one of the linchpins in Colin Powell's deeply flawed case for invasion to Congress. McCoy also ridicules the ticking time bomb scenario, a nuclear weapon in Times Square, a guy in custody, no time for lawyers. That's the approach of TV's 24, and Gibney includes a snippet of the TV show in his film. In this context, it's a laugh riot. My favorite speaker in Taxi to the Dark Side is former FBI agent Jack Clunan, who gives us a sample of a friendly interrogation. "Something I can do for your kids," he says. "You want them educated? I can get them educated. Help me find a strategy to get you back home. I was ready to confess to every lie I've ever told." Taxi to the Dark Side winds back to Dilawar, turned in for a bounty after a rocket attack. And not only wasn't he involved, but the attack never happened. What's almost as bizarre is that the interrogators who whacked his thighs to the point where a postmortem called them pulpified concluded he wasn't guilty. But they hated him for screaming, and the thing developed its own momentum, and no one was overseeing them, and this great documentary transcends the gory details and leaves you brooding on the human capacity for cruelty.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.